The views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the program host, guests, and participants, and not necessarily those of KKRN Community Radio and Acorn Community Enterprises or the underwriters of this station. Good morning. Welcome to KKRN and Off the Shelf with Mary. I'm your host, Dr. Mary Mitchell. I'll be sharing some of my favorite old and new nonfiction books about philosophy, spiritual psychology, science, and metaphysics. These might offer just the knowledge you've been looking for to enhance your life. Today, we'll take a look at two books. The first is The End of War, published in 2010 by Captain Paul Chappelle. And the second is Gandhi the Man by Eknath Esrarian, published in 1972. Who is Captain Paul Chappelle? He graduated from West Point in 2002 and served in the Army for 7 years. Since then, he's been part of the leadership of the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation and is currently their Peace Literacy Director. He's published 6 books as part of their Road to Peace series. In the foreword to The End of War, author Gavin DeBecker wrote that it's fear, not just distance, that separates the people of the world from each other. National leaders retain power by dividing people, and violence and war thrive on this separation. DeBecker's work focuses on fear, and it led him to the same conclusion as Captain Chappelle, that only by understanding those who intensely frighten us will they cease being the alien monsters of our nightmares. It was in West Point that Captain Chappelle learned about the dangers of blind obedience. He was taught to question every order he was given to determine whether it was lawful and to ensure that it didn't violate the Geneva Conventions. He challenges the reader to think about how we determine who is seeking the truth when it comes to conflict or war. Are they serving humanity or their own selfish interests? Chappelle found a powerful tool in a story called Plato's Cave, and it helped him to question everything, such as the conflicting messages he heard and read about every day in the media and heard from politicians and from others in society. Written by Socrates over 2,500 years ago, Plato's Cave is an allegory about seeing through illusions around us in order to realize our full potential as human beings. The main theme of Plato's Cave is that human perception alone cannot give us true knowledge, and instead, real knowledge can only come from philosophical reasoning. In the story, a group of prisoners has lived their entire lives in a cave, only able to see shadows cast on the walls from the cave from a fire somewhere behind them. It was figures created by what they called puppet masters in front of the fire that created the shadowy images on the wall. To the prisoners, the shadows were reality. Today, the puppet masters represent those in society with the ability to control us and manipulate information, such as politicians and the media. The fire that the puppet masters manipulated was distorted knowledge. For some of the prisoners, distorted knowledge was accepted as real. For others, they also wanted to be a puppet master to manipulate the suffering of others. But there was also an ignored option, how to get out of the cave. There was a light at the end of the cave, but it was so bright it hurt their eyes. And yes, for us, sometimes the truth hurts. The ones who did go back into the cave to bring others out into a new life, but they found most were stubborn and ignorant, and would not leave, and instead stayed focused on the shadows. So often, people resist new knowledge because others would then have higher expectations of them, or they could be lazy and just comfortable with the shadows on the wall. The only thing that keeps humans in a cave is a lack of ambition. So the key lesson from Plato's allegory of the cave is to question every assumption you have about reality, what you call real. This is a powerful way to develop the skill of thinking for yourself and discovering your own unique solutions to any problem. In Chapter 2, Chappelle explores the nature of aggression, since war breeds aggression and hostility. In addition to war, as a person of color, his personal experience with racism, childhood trauma, and other forms of suffering, he could see how it leads to increased aggression in human beings. He compares hatred and violence to sharp rocks. When they're thrown at us, we can get hurt if we're not mindful. And rocks can easily traumatize impressionable children in ways that are far worse. Years of being pelted with sharp rocks himself led him to struggle with his yearning to inflict the same violence on others. He describes his mind as he grew up like being in a ceramic vase being filled with water, but a vase with a dangerous crack inside. So every rock or hurtful experience built up pressure along the fracture. The more stress along the fracture increased, the urge to explode violently was within him. He wanted to learn how to repair that fracture so it wouldn't happen. To solve the problem, he confronted several questions. Why does human aggression exist? Can we control it? Is there anything we can do to heal the aggression within our society? To begin answering these, he realized that aggression is not always violent. It comes in different forms. The basic purpose of all human aggression is to protect our community from danger. It begins as warning aggression, like a rattlesnake, rattling its tail trying to deter what might be a violent enemy. If it doesn't deter us, it's followed by hostile aggression, and the rattlesnake strikes. The same with people. A person may yell in an aggressive way to deter violence, and if it doesn't work, it may break into a fight. In thinking about our early ancestors, he wondered what happened when one tribe met another. How would they have reacted to each other? When early tribes came across each other, he believes they often met out of curiosity, and eventually tribes began to combine to form larger communities. At the same time, some tribes may have been afraid of another, and the fear resulted in aggression and ended up with war between tribes. In one example, when the first Europeans came to this continent, the local natives were curious, and they offered to share their food and goods. Curiosity kept fear under control. If the native tribes immediately had fear of the newcomers, they would have responded aggressively without thinking. But they were curious, and they were cautious. Later, it was the newcomers who wanted more of what was in this new land who started the violence. Chappelle believes the majority of aggression within our society results from misplaced fear. That's when we perceive a threat where no threat exists. Feeling insecure, we may experience fear deep inside if we're not so much insecure as frightened. People who feel very secure don't feel a need to posture every time someone insults them. They're secure in themselves. Some theories say the cause of human aggression is rejection, but rejection itself does not naturally lead to aggression. During their lifetimes, Socrates, Jesus, Henry David Thoreau, Benedict Spinoza were all rejected, but instead of responding with aggression, they responded with compassion. As he grew up, Chappelle began to understand the underlying causes of his pain, and he was able to change his perception of himself and others. He could then recognize deep pain in another person who was aggressive, and that enabled him to have empathy for that person rather than getting angry. Chappelle believes that if we learn to enjoy exploration with a curiosity about everyone we meet, we'll see the other people and their cultures with appreciation, rather than fear and aggression. It's a step we can put into action today. When we add unconditional love to appreciation, we increase the strength of our character in ways to end war. Appreciation says, live life to its fullest, while unconditional love tells us that we can do this by helping others to create a brighter future. Global peace and prosperity are truly possible when we embrace the combined power of unconditional love and appreciation. In his goal to understand the root causes of war, Chappelle found another one while he was at West Point writing a research paper one evening when his computer broke. Oh, it's that fundamental nature of reality that when something becomes more and more complex, more and more things can go wrong. I had that experience this weekend. In a complex system like a computer, one small problem leads to catastrophe, or it can. Just like a person driving their vehicle into the wrong lane can create a multiple car pileup. If untreated, a small finger cut can get infected. But we are not powerless. An increase in understanding how things work can overcome that increase in complexity. We increase our knowledge. Trying to fix a computer without knowledge is to fail until we do gather the knowledge, or a person with the knowledge, in order to succeed. And as situations become more chaotic, it's wise to respond in the opposite direction by becoming calmer. Calmness is very important to getting the tools of reason, communication, empathy, and understanding. Tools to build a more peaceful world. Another tool for evading war is, listen to this, patriotism, loving our country. So we will do our best to improve it, make it a better place for everyone. Sometimes we can be so concerned for the country that an emotion labeled moral fury provides the strength to kickstart the hard tasks. Patriotism requires us to question our government and to think critically so that America can become more humane and peaceful, a role model for the rest of the world. Moral fury is unconditional love fused with our conscience that suddenly becomes to a slow boil, and we've seen this across the country in the past 2 years. He describes a population apathetic to the suffering of its own people is like a freight train rusting away on unused tracks. While physical fury reacts to the immediate physical danger, moral fury responds to injustice. By bringing our conscience to a slow boil, moral fury generates the steam to get a train of justice rolling toward a global civilization of peace and prosperity. Let me repeat. Moral fury generates the steam to get a train of justice rolling towards a global civilization of peace and prosperity. Moral fury builds the pressure necessary to move us forward on the road to peace. Now, Gandhi and Martin Luther King waged peace with the weapons of reason, love, and creativity. Peace is won by contributing to the opponent's understanding and awareness, by transforming them into friends. Waging peace is being against the ignorance and misunderstandings that hold people hostage. Waging peace is being against hatred, manipulation, misplaced fears and aggression, greed and apathy. And the next step is to take action, to feel empowered to do something positive for peace. Chappelle finds the biggest misconception of war is the naive belief that once we begin a war that we that we can control it. But by its very nature, war is something out of control. Its essence is chaos, which is unpredictable. The chaos of war cares very little for our best laid plans. We can only control the odds, but never the outcome. Waging peace is a much more effective and reliable way to solve our problems. There are 1,000 ways to wage peace. I invite you to choose one today. KKRN is a community radio station supported by listeners and a team of volunteers who keep everything organized and running well. You're invited to support this amazing group by sending a donation to KKRN, P.O. Box 188, Round Mountain, California, 96805, or look at the donate button on the website. We also love donations of cars, trucks, boats, or motorcycles through careasy.org. And if you have questions, give us a call, 1-855-500-7444. The second book is Gandhi the Man by Eknath Iswaran. Well, who was Eknath Iswaran? He was born in India and became a professor of English literature at a leading Indian university. He met Gandhi at a retreat center before he came to the United States in 1959. A gifted teacher, he moved from education for a degree to education for a good living and gave talks on meditation and spiritual living for 40 years. Gandhi was born in 1869, at a time when the British Empire dominated India. There was nothing unusual about him except that he was very, very shy. So shy that every day as school was let out, he would run home because he could not bear to talk to anybody. He had no unusual talents and went through school as an average, self-conscious, and serious student. At the age of 13, still in high school, he was married, as was the practice of the day. After high school, he went to college, but he failed every class. His uncle suggested that he go to London and study law, a wise profession at the time. And there he tried to mimic the European lifestyle and tried to become an English gentleman. But it wasn't long before he realized that just changing the way he dressed and talked didn't change him inside. Recognized the importance of being truthful to himself, he began to experience with a simpler way of life. Anxious to leave London behind, at graduation he was offered a year-long contract at a minor clerical position with a law firm in South Africa. It was a chance to gain some experience. The case Gandhi was hired for was a very complicated one, requiring real skills in accounting to unravel years of complicated business transactions. Well, at that time, he was ignorant of bookkeeping, so he studied it deeply so he could ferret out all the details in these financial cases. But no matter how hard he worked on a case, it seemed that most cases went on for months at a time. When one case started to split a family apart, he persuaded both sides to submit to arbitration and settle out of court. In this way, the case moved forward and both sides were satisfied. Gandhi had found the secret of success, finding an opportunity for service in arbitrating difficult cases. It wasn't long before people, both white and Indian, began entrusting him with their legal work, and in a few years, at the age of 27, he had his own law business and a very good income. But the political and social repression of all Indians in South Africa made a deep impression on him. One man, who had been beaten severely by his employer, came to Gandhi for help, and through him, Gandhi got to know many other people. He visited their homes. He came to know their families, how they lived. He saw them as his brothers and sisters and identified with them more every day. When the Black Plague broke out in a squalid Indian ghetto, the sick and the dying were taken to an abandoned building, and every day Gandhi would visit them. It meant a lot to those who were sick and those taking care of them. The idea of selfless service had taken hold of him in every aspect of his life. And because of his selfless service, he became recognized as a leader of the Indian community. You know, traveling by train at that time was the most expedient method of getting from one place to another. European settlers were always traveling first class. Second class was taken by the upper stage of Indian society. Third class was left for the vast majority of Indians. And it was in cars that were very crowded with very dirty wooden benches. One of Gandhi's unexpected transformational experiences was when he had to travel by rail to another state. The company that hired him paid for a first-class seat. But that evening, when the train reached a high mountain town, another passenger got on board and saw this dark-complected man in first class and demanded that he leave. When Gandhi refused, the man called the police, who pushed Gandhi off the train without his suitcase or his coat. He was left to spend the bitterly cold night sitting in a deserted, unlit railway station. In the morning, he made the decision never to yield to force, never to use force to win a case. And from this decision, he devoted his life completely to community service. At age 37, this deep conviction blossomed into the inspiration for mass nonviolent resistance. In 1919, the British proposed what came to be known as the Black Act. Gandhi believed it would deprive Indians of what civil rights they had, since they were already getting arrested without knowing why, and they were often held for indefinite periods of time. Also, the British were using this act to suppress people who were fighting for freedom. As Indian communities gathered, they were ready for violence. But Gandhi spoke up and offered them an even higher challenge. refused to obey such degrading legislation and accept the consequences without retaliating, but without yielding an inch in their demand for fair and equal treatment under the law. Every person in that crowd agreed. His movement spread quickly through all of South Africa. It was an entirely new method of fighting. Instead of fanning hatred with hatred, violence with violence, Gandhi argued that exploitation could be overcome simply by returning love for hatred and respect for contempt, refusing to yield to injustice. He gave this new way of overcoming injustice the word satyagraha, which meant holding on to truth, and ahimsa, which meant nonviolence. Satyagraha, the objective was to convert the wrongdoer. Everywhere he went, Gandhi's message was the same. All of us are one. So when you inflict suffering on others, you're bringing suffering on yourself. He started a campaign to begin liberating the lower classes. On January 1st, 1930, the Indian Congress Party raised a new national flag in their struggle for complete independence. The British threatened violence, and everyone was worried about what would happen when the answer came to Gandhi in a dream. The government had imposed a law forbidding Indians to make their own salt, which made them dependent on a British monopoly for salt. It was a necessity of life. Gandhi saw it as the perfect symbol of colonial exploitation. He proposed to the people that they march to the coastal town of Dandi, 240 miles away, where salt from the sea was free for the taking. He encouraged everyone in India to act as if the salt laws had never been enacted. He and 78 supporters began their walk to the coast. Gandhi was 61 at the time, but had never been in better shape. He marched with a light, brisk step of an athlete, covering about 12 miles a day, stopping in every village on the way to preach the gospel of ahimsa and the duty of nonviolent non-cooperation. 24 days later, they reached the coastal town, and his nonviolent army that began with 78 people had swelled to several thousand people. The next morning, they went quietly down to the water, and Gandhi, with thousands of eyes watching every move, stooped down and pinched a bit of salt from the sand. Gandhi was arrested immediately, and he told the official who arrested him, "Sir, I am at your service." Under colonial rule, India was required to export all of its cotton at a nominal price to England, where it was manufactured into cloth and then sold back to the poor people in India at many times the price. Gandhi invited all Indians, rich or poor, to learn the age-old craft of hand spinning so that thousands of impoverished people could be self-employed, self-reliant, and have self-respect. The cloth was called khadi, and it became a symbol of independence. From that point on, Gandhi wore khadi everywhere he went. Eventually, thousands of British textile workers were put out of work, and they were very angry. But Gandhi went to their city to plead the case of his people. He asked this great crowd of unemployed mill workers to please listen for a few minutes. He said, "You tell me that 3 million people are out of work here. In my country, 300 million people are out of work at least 6 months every year. You say there are days when you can only get bread and butter for dinner, but my people often go for days on end without any food at all." At the end of Gandhi's talk, his way of being frank and yet respectful won them over, and the crowd cheered. The purpose of satyagraha is not to redress grievances, but to resolve the underlying sources of conflict, the distrust, and to see that there is a common value to his nonviolent vision, because we have much more to gain in harmony than in discord. It follows, therefore, that it must have its root in love. Its object is not to punish the opponent or hurt him. Even while being non-cooperative, we must make him feel that we're a friend, and be heartfelt by being of service. What's good for oneself equally applies to the whole universe. I hope you've enjoyed hearing about Captain Paul Chappelle's idea on waging peace instead of war, and Gandhi's philosophy of satyagraha and ahimsa, resolving distrust through respect, love, and nonviolence. Perhaps you can use it for good in your life and the lives of everyone you love. And for those you don't love, use it for their good anyway. It's another small step in bringing peace to the world. You know, the music for this show is from an acoustical guitar CD by Lemming Shepherds called Symphony for the Senses, and it even comes with a full-color booklet on their many adventures. I want to thank you for listening to Off the Shelf with me, Mary, courtesy of KKRN, a nonprofit, non-commercial educational station supported by listeners like you. And so until next week, may peace be with you.